Hello and welcome to the Europeans podcast with, for the first time ever, a married Katie Lee. How was it, Katie?
Oh, it was lovely, thank you. I got married at Town Hall and then we had lunch on a boat that was flying the Ukrainian flag. It was very beautiful. And now I'm looking forward to my honeymoon in Berlin next week, Dominic.
With me!
With you, my other husband. Yeah, it's not a very conventional honeymoon that I'm going with Dominic instead of my actual husband, as well as our producers, Katz and Wojciech. But that shouldn't let it get in the way of being a beautiful and romantic trip.
I really think you've misunderstood the concept, but fine.
I've never had one before.
I'm happy you're straight back to work on the podcast with me.
Yeah, no rest for the wicked.
Thank you for sharing with me, Alex.
How are you, Dominic Kramer?
Yeah, I'm fine. Nothing as exciting as a wedding, but I did start rehearsal this week on a new production of an opera called Der Freischütz here in Amsterdam. And it's directed by this guy, Kirill Serebrennikov, who you might have heard about. He's this really interesting Russian film and theatre director who, yeah, I'm sure a lot of people will have heard about him because he was in the news a lot the last few years because he was put under house arrest in 2017 for apparent fraud charges, which were seen by most people in my industry as simply being a way to keep him locked away because Putin and the Kremlin didn't like the work he was making, work that was critiquing authoritarianism and featured LGBT characters. And yeah, in fact, he's been in the papers again just this week because the Bolshoi Theatre in Moscow has cancelled his performances because he's been publicly critical of Russia invading Ukraine.
Wow.
He managed to get out of Russia at the end of March. I think he's now living in Berlin, but he's now in Amsterdam rehearsing with me and lots of other people. And yeah, it's really exciting to have the pleasure to work with such an interesting artist, especially one who's been literally locked away for so many years. And this production includes music by Tom Waits, so it's maybe something for you, Katie.
Very cool. Bit of a rock and roll opera. Love it.
Absolutely.
Weddings and very exciting shows aside, what have we got going on this week?
Well, this week we're going to be talking to the founder of one of Europe's most intriguing magazines and websites. Chris De Decker is the founder of the Low Tech magazine, a magazine that highlights the potential of past knowledge and technologies for designing a sustainable society. He runs the magazine from Barcelona, and a version of the magazine is available online on a low tech website, which is powered by a single small solar panel on the balcony of his apartment. It's a fascinating idea, which brings up a lot of questions about how our internet use is affecting the climate and what we should be doing about that. We'll be getting the answers from Chris later on in the show, but for now, it's time for Who has had a good week this week?
I'm going to say it's been a good week for new ideas. Let's go to Strasbourg, Dominic, because there has been a lot going on in the EU bubble this week. And I think it's fair to say that it's mostly gone over the heads of people that don't live in that bubble. So I'm going to try to penetrate the bubble for you. This week saw the wrapping up of a big EU thing called the Conference on the Future of Europe. Did you follow this thing?
Not really. It was quite difficult to follow it, I feel.
Yeah, I have to be honest and say that I didn't follow it much either. It's one of those EU initiatives that gets talked about with a lot of fanfare and then sadly doesn't really cut through that much to most citizens who have like busy lives and jobs across the continent. But the conference was basically 6 months of citizen consultations across the whole EU about what people want from the European Union. It costs like 20 million euros at least to run this thing. And then there was this big report drawn up about what people said during the consultations. There were 49 specific proposals in it from the citizens. And then this report got presented to the EU bigwigs this week. It was super, super wide ranging. The ideas in it include everything from people wanting affordable childcare across the EU to giving more power to the European Parliament. But there's a big question mark hanging over whether the EU will actually do anything with these suggestions. The point of this exercise was to make the EU feel less out of touch with the citizens that it serves. But if all of these suggestions get ignored, it'll actually make the EU feel more out of touch than ever. So there's a lot of pressure. And there's already one big obstacle to some of these things happening, and that is that some of the proposals, you'd need to change the EU treaties to make them happen. Things like getting rid of the need for unanimous agreement amongst the EU member states on certain things. And there are already some countries that have said very clearly that they do not want to change the EU treaties. So that could put the kibosh on some of the suggestions.
I have to say, the main reason that I noted that this conference was wrapping up was because European Twitter went a bit bonkers about some interpretive dance in the aisles of the European Parliament, which produced some quite bizarre videos.
Yeah, we need to talk about the dancing. So all of this happened on Europe Day, May the 9th. And as part of that general celebration of Europeanness and this big report coming out, they brought all of these young people in brightly coloured t-shirts to do interpretive dance around the MEPs in the Parliament in Strasbourg. And I don't want to be mean, because it was quite a sweet and earnest idea, and all of these dancers came from across Europe, but it just looked like exactly the kind of deeply uncool pro-EU flash dance that someone in an EU office would take like 5 minutes to plan. You know, like, what represents the future of Europe? I know, young people in bright clothes doing funky dancing among the MEPs. It was just really cringy. There's a video of it on our Twitter for anyone who wants to see it. But cringy dancing aside, I wanted to talk about the other big idea that came out of this big day in Strasbourg, apart from the conference on the future of Europe. Because Emmanuel Macron got up to give one of his mammoth speeches. And as we all know, Macron is someone who likes to think of himself as having a vision for this continent. He was actually the person who came up with the idea for the conference on the future of Europe a couple of years back. And of course, Macron has just been re-elected as president of France. France currently holds the EU presidency. So this was him bringing that momentum to Strasbourg and saying, this is where I think Europe should be going. And the biggest idea that he put forward in this speech was a new organization called the European Political Community.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you're going to be telling me about this, because I've seen the headlines and haven't really read about what it is. What is it?
Well, the general idea is to create some sort of organization for countries that are not members of the EU, but they're like one step less integrated. So they'd be countries that want to have a close relationship with the EU and that the EU also wants to be close to them. But for whatever reason, they're not currently in the EU itself. And the two most prominent examples of countries that Macron suggested could be in this new club were Ukraine and the UK.
Do either of them actually want to be in this club?
I don't know. It's very early days yet.
Okay, but quite radically different situations for these two countries. Like, Ukraine have been wanting to join the EU recently and the UK have left.
Yes, thank you for the reminder. But yeah, with Ukraine, I mean, as soon as the war broke out in February, there were immediate calls for Ukraine to be allowed to join the EU, including from President Zelensky, just so that Ukraine could be much better supported by the EU and maybe even for the EU to declare war on Russia because of a fellow member being under attack. That idea lost energy pretty quickly. It normally takes years and years for countries to go through the process of joining the EU. There's all kinds of hoops to jump through in terms of proving that the democracy in that country is up to the standards that the EU expects, and proving that corruption isn't a massive problem. And even these days, proving that the environment is protected enough in the country. So there's currently five countries that have candidate status. All of them have been waiting for years. They are Albania, North Macedonia, Montenegro, Serbia, and Turkey. And there's also two other countries that are in the waiting room just to get official candidate status. They are Kosovo and Bosnia and Herzegovina. So yeah, this idea of fast-tracking Ukraine into the EU tomorrow, lots of EU politicians tried to shut down that idea pretty quickly, much to the disappointment of the Ukrainian government. But this club that Macron is suggesting, this political community, it does appear to be an attempt at a pragmatic solution to how slow the process of joining the EU is. And I do think in general, the logic behind it is geopolitical. Macron wants to keep these countries close, and he absolutely does not want them falling into the sphere of influence of Russia or other hostile powers like China, for example. This is part of a strategy. So the new political community, he suggested it could be a place for the EU and its non-EU neighbours to come to agreements on stuff like trade and immigration. It's actually quite similar to an idea that got floated last month by Enrico Letta, the former Italian Prime Minister. He suggested a kind of European confederation that could start as some kind of economic club, and then gradually maybe they could add different areas where they cooperate, maybe even defence.
This sounds a bit like that quite old idea of having different layers of integration with different countries being differently involved with each other.
Yeah, so this idea of a multi-speed Europe is something that people have talked about for literally decades. And it's kind of controversial. Not all countries want it. Some of the countries that are less keen on ever closer union, They think the whole process of integration should only move at a speed that all members are comfortable with. But to be honest, the EU is already multi-speed, really. If you think about things like Schengen or the Euro, not all EU countries are involved with those. So this idea of a new political community that would create a way of keeping friendly European countries involved and working closely with the EU, it's kind of an extension of that multi-speed idea. And Macron made clear that this club could be open to countries that are hoping to join the EU, but it could also be open to countries that have left the EU, like our home country of the United Kingdom, for example.
So what happens next with this plan? Like, has it got any chance of actually making any progress?
Oh, I have no idea. And neither does anybody else. The speech was really light on details. Like, I don't know what the rules of the club would be, or whether you could get kicked out of the club if you do something bad, when it would be set up. We really don't know much at all about how Macron wants any of this to happen, which is quite unusual, actually. Normally, his office gives out policy briefings on his ideas, but there was none of this. And some of the journalists who follow Macron have suggested that this speech was actually a little bit improvised. And all of this happened just yesterday at the time of recording. So we haven't really heard that many reactions from the countries that could potentially be in this club. So I don't know if it'll go anywhere, but I don't want to be too cynical about it. I mean, to his credit, even though Macron can be quite annoying and like sometimes looks like he wants to be the self-appointed king of Europe and the man with the vision or whatever, he does have ideas and enthusiasm for closer integration. And he does try to come up with practical solutions. There aren't really that many other current national European leaders bringing that kind of energy at the moment. So yeah, light on details, but it's an idea at least.
Well, we'll see.
Who's had a bad week?
It's been a bad week for another European integrated group called the European Federation of Foie Gras.
Okay, good segue.
Well, actually, it's been a bad week for all lovers of foie gras, as there is a severe shortage right now, thanks to the current bird flu epidemic. And Michelin-starred chefs in France are up in arms at their shortage of foie gras deliveries. One French chef told CNN in an interview that they hadn't received any foie gras for the entire week, poor things.
Quelle horreur.
But some animal rights activists are naturally pretty pleased for chefs and customers to have to get used to eating less of this duck or goose liver pate, because the foie gras industry has long been seen as one of the cruelest corners of the meat industry. The production requires the force feeding of ducks and geese to expand their livers to about 10 times their natural size, all to achieve that rich, fatty taste. I've never actually tried it myself, but I hear it's rich and fatty, and I personally think it sounds frankly disgusting.
You know, it's not something I eat very often, and it is obviously horribly cruel, but I am ashamed to say that I love the taste of it. It is delicious.
Oh my.
I know.
Goodness.
And actually, I would love. Hang on, here is a good business idea. You know how there's like really convincing versions of like vegan cheese and like vegan whatever these days? Vegan foie gras, what about that? Someone needs to make that.
It exists already. You can get it in the shops.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to Google it one sec.
There are loads and loads of recipes for it online, and you can buy it.
That looks pretty good.
No excuse, Katie Lee.
It's definitely the right colour. All right, I'm going to taste this one and get back to you.
Please do. And you might have to, actually, frankly, because this is the third consecutive year that there's been a decline in output of foie gras, and it's the worst year yet. France is, naturally, the biggest producer of foie gras in the world, producing at least half of the world's output. There's also quite a bit produced in Bulgaria and Hungary. But according to CNN, France is expected to cut its foie gras output by about 50% this year.
Wow, that's actually massive. Like, why is it so bad this year?
Well, it's because the avian flu or bird flu epidemic has been really bad in Europe this year. There have been record levels of infections, and it has particularly affected some of the areas in France where poultry farming is most intensive. The French Agricultural Ministry have said that some 18 million birds have been culled due to bird flu since November. This has, of course, also led to other poultry food shortages and price rises for customers, something I think we're going to be talking a lot more about in general over the next few years, not only due to bird flu, but also because of the impact of the war in Ukraine. Bird flu has been particularly devastating for the free-range poultry industry. And in some countries, like the UK, there have been periods of time when free-range eggs have not been available at all in supermarkets, as birds were forced by the UK government to be kept inside to avoid catching the virus. They think these sedentary farm birds catch it from passing migratory birds, so keeping them inside is meant to limit that likelihood.
And sorry to make it all about us, but is there a risk that this bird flu could spill over to humans? We've kind of been in this area before, haven't we?
Yeah, well, humans have in rare cases caught it. And when they do, they can sometimes get very sick. Fortunately, at the moment, the virus cannot pass between humans. Infected humans are people who have had some close and usually regular contact with birds, either because they work on a poultry farm, they've been playing around with dead birds, or in one case in the UK, it was because a man was living with about 20 ducks inside his home, probably not to be recommended.
As you do.
The bird flu epidemic was actually the epidemic that scientists were expecting before the coronavirus pandemic came along, and it still could happen. The virus could mutate to be able to be passed between humans, and that could be pretty scary from what I've been reading. But it's not an immediate threat for now.
And is there any vaccine for the strains of bird flu that we already have at the moment?
Well, France is actually experimenting with vaccines for the ducks and the geese. But if they work, they aren't actually expected to become widely used until late 2023. The good news is that for now, the French government announced this week that the bird flu epidemic in the country seems to be waning, and some restrictions that had been in place to keep birds inside are now being relaxed. But it's worth remembering that just as there are theories that the coronavirus pandemic began in part due to intensive breeding of animals, and there was that Q fever outbreak in the Netherlands that was linked to Dutch goat farms, it's now pretty widely acknowledged by epidemiologists and international bodies that intensive poultry farming makes outbreaks of avian influenza viruses worse and more likely. So for many animal rights activists, it is seen as a no-brainer that the production of foie gras should be banned. Not only is it seen as being incredibly cruel for the animals, but it's also believed to be increasing the risk of further viral epidemics.
I mean, I'm kind of sold on it from what you've just said. It is already banned in some places, isn't it?
Yes. The serving or producing of foie gras has already been banned in a few parts of the world. India has a ban on importing foie gras. It's illegal to produce it in various countries like Australia and the UK. It was actually expected that Boris Johnson's government might announce a ban on selling foie gras in the UK during the Queen's speech, which happened today on the day we're recording, but it didn't turn up in it. He ducked out of that one.
Oh, he's here all week, listeners.
I guess a UK ban could have reduced demand and helped out with these French supply shortages. But in the meantime, the representative of the Foie Gras Producers Association said that people will need to deal with the shortages by getting used to sharing their foie gras amongst each other. No need to share it with me. Thank you kindly.
It's not really duck or goose related, but my mum just got two rescued battery hens arrive at her house.
Really? Whoa, I didn't know you could adopt.
Yeah, it's really exciting. They're called Sharon and Tracy.
I want to get some too.
One of the things that we're going to Berlin to strategize next week is how to make this podcast financially sustainable, because we love making it, but we are constantly broke, which is where you guys come in. You can help us keep this podcast in existence. If it's something that you enjoy listening to each week, all you need to do is chuck a little bit of money our way via the website Patreon. Every little helps, and all the details are at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast.
This week, a big shout out to Sandy Copping for becoming our latest Patreon. Thank you very much, Sandy. We hope that this podcast is like doing a little bit to make Europe feel a little bit more interconnected, and we hope it's brightening up some people's week. So do consider it if you have the money.
Among the various perks for our lovely supporters, if you sign up this week, you get to take part in our exclusive Eurovision prediction game, which we'll be playing in real time during Eurovision on Saturday night. And the winner will receive a Europeans tote bag. It's very exciting.
It is. I'm so excited.
as often noted on this podcast, there's basically nothing you can do in this world that doesn't have an environmental impact. If you haven't already heard our interview from a couple of weeks back on the climate impact of the fashion industry, go back and have a listen. It's a good one. But along with wearing clothes, one of the things that I think humans tend to do without really thinking about the environmental consequences is going on the internet. Even listening to this podcast right now has required some computer servers to talk to each other. And that uses energy.
No one's going to listen anymore, Katie.
Please still listen. Please still listen. Well, actually, as a chaser to that, you might have seen some apocalyptic headlines in recent years about how much energy the world's Netflix and YouTube addictions are using up every year. And it is really important to note that going online is much less terrible in terms of the energy that it uses than it was a decade ago. Technology is getting better. Yes, we all rely on giant data servers that need to be kept cool, but we're getting better and more efficient at running these giant data servers. And that's something to be celebrated. However, going online is still something that uses up a lot of energy. The internet is predicted to use up to a fifth of the world's electricity by 2025. So it's always interesting to think about alternative ways of running websites, of keeping them online. And one person who has thought a lot about how to run the internet in a sustainable way is Chris Dedeker. He is the co-founder of Low Tech Magazine, a website about sustainability. But since 2018, a solar-powered version of the site has been available. This website is entirely dependent on a solar power system set up on Chris's balcony in Barcelona. And because of that, this website is weather-dependent. So if Barcelona goes through a rainy period, the website can go offline, which is not something that we're used to as very demanding internet users in 2022. Why even bother to make a solar-powered website in the first place? Well, we were very intrigued by the whole thing. So we gave Chris a call in Barcelona to find out more. Where did this idea come from in the first place, this idea of building a solar-powered website?
I have been researching historical ways to work with renewable energy. So renewable energy is not something that we started using in the 20th century. It has a history of hundreds, thousands of years. For example, you have sailboats, you have windmills, old-fashioned windmills that only work when the wind blows. And that approach I applied to something more modern as the internet, as a website. So it's basically a website that works as a sailing boat in the sense that it only works when renewable energy is available. And if it's not, it just stops working.
And how often does that actually happen? I mean, you live in Barcelona and I believe the solar panel is on your balcony. So I imagine it's pretty sunny quite a lot of the year in Barcelona, but how often does the website actually go offline?
Well, we had an uptime of about 95% in both 2020, 2021. So that means we're offline for like 22 days a year. And that's mostly in winter.
Would you like it to be possible to use the website continuously? Or is it part of the point that you can't do that?
There's two reasons why it goes offline. One is the fact that batteries are the most unsustainable component of any off-grid solar system. So it takes a lot of energy to produce them and you have to replace them pretty often. If you want your website to be always online, you need to add a lot of batteries because you need to be prepared for quite unusual weather events. Like recently, we had almost 2 weeks without sun, which is pretty unusual here, but it does happen. So there's a very good reason why we are not 100% online, because that would mean that we add so many batteries that the whole advantage of the website disappears. But the second reason is also that one of the reasons why the energy use on the internet keeps growing is that we spend increasingly more time online. So years ago, it was just whenever we were sitting on a desk and on a computer. But now, because of smartphones, wireless internet, we're constantly online. And that is something that we also would like to highlight in the sense that why does a website need to be online forever? And why do we have to be connected for 16 hours a day? In that sense, we need to go offline to keep the system sustainable. And on the other hand, we like that it goes offline now and then to make people more aware of their internet addiction, let's say.
I think it would not be such a bad idea if my Instagram wasn't accessible for large parts of the day. I'm sure I would feel a lot better and be more productive. Yeah, it's interesting. the energy use of internet use is quite invisible to everyday users like us. So say like I go on a website like YouTube, what are the things that are actually costing energy?
We have this idea that the internet is some kind of thing that floats around in the sky. It's like the cloud. All the terminology also refers to that. It's like as if it's something immaterial. But in reality, of course, you have a massive infrastructure to keep these websites online. And that is data centers, of course, the servers, the computers where we store the content that is available on the internet. Then you have the whole network infrastructure. And then you have all the devices that we use to access the internet. And altogether, this means that the internet, instead of a solution for energy use, has become actually another problem.
So looking at the solar-powered version of Low Tech Magazine's website, the design of the website is pretty simple. Is that because it has to be simple?
Indeed, it has to be simple. We based our design on the first websites ever made, like early 1990s. Those were static websites, which are much more energy efficient than the dynamic websites that we are using today. If you want to have to run a website on a small solar panel, you need a small server. And if you use a small server, which is like our server only uses 1 to 2 watts of power, it's very little. But on a server like that, you cannot build the typical website that we build today. So you really have to reinvent the website, actually, and build everything lightweight.
Is there more broadly a conversation in the coding community about how to make websites more sustainable?
It's not coming out of nowhere. I think people in web design have been aware of these problems for a long time. So people who build websites, I think they know they are building a lot of crappy websites, and maybe because of clients want it or because of the tools are available. So it becomes all very overbuilt in a way. We are not the first ones to build a lightweight website, but I think the fact that it was solar powered and lightweight and part of a magazine that is already quite known, it got a lot of attention, and many people have started to build similar lightweight websites, solar powered and not solar powered. But it seems like we kind of accidentally made a milestone in web design.
But just to be clear, there are two versions of the Low Tech Magazine website, right? There's a normal version of the website that isn't reliant on solar power and doesn't have these kind of grainy 1990s pictures. Some people suggest it's maybe a bit hypocritical to have two versions of the website. Why are there two versions of the website?
It's a bit a victim of its own success in the sense that Low Tech Magazine has been around for a very long time. And we thought by launching the solar powered website, now everybody will move from the old website to the new website. But what happened instead is that we attracted a whole new public of people who are interested in web design. But at the same time, not all of our readers are interested in web design. These are two communities that want different things. So we could either make the solar powered website less radical in its design, get rid of the battery meter, reinstall color images, but then it loses its appeal as a statement in web design. I think the most important thing to say is it's a work in progress. So we have to find a solution as fast as possible.
I think a lot of us assume that new technology has to be a big part of the solution when it comes to dealing with the climate crisis. And from what I understand, Low Tech Magazine is often looking back into the past for solutions. Are you saying that with Low Tech Magazine, that in fact we should be leaning less on new technology to solve the world's problems?
Yes, definitely. What I learned from 15, 17 years of Low Tech Magazine by now is that if you want a solution for a problem, just look at the problem in a wider historical context. Any book about any technology starts with a little history, and then it usually starts early 20th century as if nothing happened before. And then you get really not a good overview of the problem. Humanity has been around for thousands of years. And what I do with every article is like, I take the whole historical context, the whole history of humanity, for example, a theme like heating or hunting or food production. And then if you do it in that way, it becomes much more clear what is exactly the problem and also what's the solution, because people did many things before without fossil fuels and it also worked. And it's not that I want to go back to the past. So the website is also a good example of that. We went back to the web design tools from the early 90s, but it's not a copy of those systems. So I don't want to go back to the Middle Ages or the Stone Age or whatever era in history. But there's a lot of inspiration to be found that you can apply to modern technology and old ways of knowledge that can be useful if you combine them with new technologies.
There's a big conversation right now about trying to decrease our fossil fuel consumption here in Europe, specifically to decrease dependence on Russian fossil fuels, especially at the moment. Are there any tips from your website on things that our listeners can easily do?
Yeah, there's a ton of tips, I guess. If you look at fossil fuel use in Europe, like one quarter is motorized transportation and another quarter is heating buildings. Me personally, I don't contribute anything. I don't have a heating system and I don't have motorized transportation. So I already slashed that fossil fuel using tool. And for heating, if you look at that topic in a historical context, you see that we have a very weird way of finding thermal comfort because we use fossil fuels to heat the air in rooms. So the volume of air in buildings, in rooms. And we think that is normal because we have always known it like that. But in a wider historical context, you see that people have never done that in history. They were always heating persons, heating bodies instead of heating spaces. And so they used local radiant energy systems like tile stoves, for example. And they also used all kinds of personal heating devices like hot water bottles. And of course, also a lot of local insulation, for example, in the form of clothes. So what we do now in winter, we crank up the heating system to 20 to 23 degrees and then we're sitting watching TV in a t-shirt. That's not how people used to do it. If you talk about body insulation, for example, the type of clothes that we have now, like thermal underwear, merino wool clothes, there's a lot of evolution of clothes technology in the 20th century that can be used to lower the heating energy that we use. And for transportation, of course, yeah, just don't drive cars. You can get anywhere by bike and don't take planes, travel by train. Cooking is also very much dependent on fossil fuels. There's also a very easy solution. It's the fireless cooker. So you start cooking your food on a real fire. And once it's boiling, you take it off the fire, you put it in an insulated box, you close the lid, and it just keeps cooking without any further input of energy. And in that way, you easily slash your energy use for cooking in half. Any topic has these low-tech solutions that if we would apply all these older technologies, and often you can improve them, yeah, you could have a modern way, a kind of modern life that is not problematic. Somewhere there is a ideal compromise between modern life, which is about convenience, comfort, cleanliness, all this speed, and not killing the planet that we depend on.
The solar-powered version of Low Tech Magazine's website is well worth exploring, solar.lowtechmagazine.com. We at the Europeans would like to recommend the article on the history of the hot water bottle. Mm. It is an amazing piece of technology. You're quite a fan of hot water bottles, aren't you?
No, I'm not actually.
Oh, got that wrong.
I use microwavable bean bags.
Oh yeah, your little bean bags.
And yeah, I sometimes just don't put the heating on and instead microwave the bean bag. And then I like stay warm. Hours.
The thing that I really liked about this article was that it also explored the idea of using other humans as hot water bottles. And at my wedding, my baby nephew was basically used like that. He was just handed around as a hot water bottle. It's a very cute hot water bottle.
And functional.
And functional. What have you been enjoying this week?
I listened to a really brilliantly produced two-part introduction to the so-called Wagatha Christie case from the Today in Focus podcast. Do you know about this case, Katie?
No, what is this?
Ah, okay. Well, like it's you're not going to be able to avoid it now you've heard about it because it's going to be all over the news for the next however many weeks. It's a libel case that started this week in the UK's High Court to settle whether or not Colleen Rooney libeled Rebecca Vardy when she publicly accused her of selling information about her, private information, to the Sun newspaper.
I do remember this. I just didn't know it was called the Wagatha Christie case. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's called the Wagatha Christie case because Colleen Rooney did like some pretty amazing sleuthing to work out who she thought it was that had been selling her information, but it might not be. Anyway, it's really complicated. Both women are wives of top English football players, and that's why it's called WAGS, because that's the old slightly sexist term, do you think?
It's got a very sort of turn of the noughties vibe to it, hasn't it?
Yeah, it does. But the story is therefore getting a lot of media attention, and this description probably makes you want to run for the hills. And to be honest, that would be a very valid response. But I found this two-part intro to the case from Today in Focus quite emotionally nuanced while still cleverly unfolding this gripping story bit by bit in the way that can just sometimes work so well on a podcast. I'm honestly glad that I know the background of what's going on, but I am going to try and ignore the daily updates from the trial and leave the court to decide who wins, because it is a pretty tragic case, that's for sure, whoever you decide to believe. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
Well, I've been rather busy this week getting married, so I hope you'll forgive me for...
It's a cake recommendation.
It's a cake recommendation. It's a vegan faux gras recommendation. Maybe I will include one of those actually in the show notes. But yeah, I hope you'll forgive me for borrowing a suggestion from a listener. But I wanted to flag up a book that was spotted by our listener, Fintan Burke, who also hasn't read it yet, but thought it looked really interesting. The book is called Multiples, and it contains 12 stories in 18 languages by 61 authors. How is that possible, I hear you ask? Well, Multiples is an experiment in translation. It's described on the cover of the book as literary entertainment, and it works kind of like Chinese whispers, if you know that game. You know when you whisper a sentence into someone's ear, and then they whisper it into the next person's ear, but sometimes they hear it slightly wrong, and then by the end of the line of people, the story is completely different. This is like that. So the first writer translates the story into English, the second writer takes that English language story and translates it into a different language, then gets translated back into English, and so on and so on. And there's some really famous authors who've taken part in this weird and wonderful translated storytelling project. Authors like J.M. Coetzee, Javier Marias, Zadie Smith. So if you can get your hands on a copy, I do think it's worth checking out. It kind of reminds me of those Google Translate songs on YouTube. Have you ever seen those?
No.
It's like an entire genre of YouTube video where people take famous songs and then they translate them into a chain of languages using Google Translate.
How fun.
And then back into the original language, at which point it's barely recognizable. It's a really fun waste of everyone's time.
This book sounds fun though. I want it. I've got more good news to celebrate from the world of women's football as my happy ending for this week's episode. This time it's from Italy, where the women's top division has finally become professional.
Woohoo!
The women's Series A division has been around since 1968. And at the beginning, the women were playing basically only for their travel expenses. And a few decades in, they gained an amateur status that meant they could be paid, but their salaries were capped due to the fact that they were not officially professionals. But from the beginning of next season, starting on July the 1st, women can and will be paid properly. Not, I'm sure, as much as their male counterparts, but a really good step in the right direction. Congratulations.
We actually heard about this good news from Impact, from Les Glorieuses, which is a French bilingual newsletter on women's rights, which I'm also going to whack into the ISO Inspo section this week. It's a bumper crop.
That's all we've got time for this week. And next week, yeah, we're taking that break to meet with our two producers in real life for the first time ever, which is very exciting. But in the meantime, we'll be tweeting probably quite a bit about Eurovision this week. Forgive us. At Europeans Pod. On Instagram, we're at Europeans Podcast. And if you want to join our Eurovision sweepstake and be in with a chance of winning one of our rare Angry Macron tote bags, head to our Patreon page on Facebook and fill in your predictions after the second semi-final has taken place.
This episode was produced by me and Wojciech Oleksiak, with thanks also to our other producer, Kat Laszlo. And we are members of the Are We Europe podcasting family. You can find more continental podcasts at the link in the show notes.
Bye.
Cheers.